Broadcasting live to the world now, it's Sheila Zelinsky.
This is a very sinister Luciferian eugenics plan. Sheila Zelinsky. These spineless weasels preach what people want to hear. They replace repentance with dreams of the good life.
Mindless minions.
Dying daily, taking up your cross. Suffering and sacrificing have been superseded with name it and claim it. And as dark as I know it looks out there, the good news is that God is advancing his kingdom. And it's very exciting to be a part of his great commission.
It's Sheila Zelinsky.
The Sheila Zelinsky Show, the only show to give you the truth behind the headlines, prophecy, and the deeper things of God. Now, here is your host, End Time Watchwoman, Sheila Zelinsky.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Sheila Zelinsky Show for this Thursday, July 2nd, 2015 edition. I broadcast weekdays right here on Worldwide Christian Radio, folks. And if you haven't signed up for the podcast, do so by going to my website and click on that big pink button. And folks, do remember, you can join me in the chat every day by simply clicking on that little button that says join us in the chat on my website. You can't miss that button. It's at the top right. So join us in the chat every day and come and get to know the other listeners. And again, it's a really great way for us all to connect. We have a great show today, folks. My guest is Patrick Wood. Patrick is an author and lecturer who has studied elite globalization policy since the late 1970s, when he partnered with one of my favorite authors, the late Anthony C. Sutton, to co-author Trilaterals Over Washington, Volumes 1 and 2, and he really remains the leading expert on the elite Trilateral Commission, their policies, the new international economic order, and I'm going to tell you what, this man knows his stuff. He just wrote an incredible book called Technocracy Rising. He's a frequent speaker and guest on radio shows around the nation. And I'm going to tell you, he knows his stuff when it comes to technocracy, transhumanism, and scientism. And it is my pleasure to have him on the program for the first time. Patrick Wood, welcome to the program. It is a pleasure, sir.
Hello, Sheila. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, one of the things I'm very fascinated about your book, and of course, it's such a pleasure to have you on, because this book really does connect some dots for people. And I think where I want to start off with this is a lot of people have been trying to tie dots together with all of this, but we can't really fight an enemy, Patrick, that we don't know. And what I like about your book is it really helps people fully perceive who the enemy is, what the strategy is, but it also ties in a lot of what's going on, and it connects the tentacles of the mighty octopus, if you will. It really does. Get into why you wrote your book and what the missing link for people is.
Well, indeed, I've been chasing this fox, you know, for almost 40 years now, Sheila. And back in the 1970s, I started writing about globalization with Professor Anthony Sutton, and we co-authored two books, Trilaterals Over Washington versus Volumes 1 and 2 back in those days, and did a lot of speaking, a lot of writing, and a lot of original research to come up with what we knew about the Trilateral Commission's so-called New International Economic Order. That's the phrase they used everywhere on everything they wrote, that they wanted to create a new international economic order. We pretty much nailed it back in those days. We didn't see the future exactly, but and we didn't know a lot of things about anything about technocracy that we're going to talk about today. But years later, in fact, just a few years ago from now, I ran across the topic of historic technocracy, and it was it was at first a curiosity to me. I thought I knew something about American history. It turns out I didn't know nearly as much as I thought, and I was greatly humbled by missing this one. But back in the 1930s, there was a huge movement in America, started in America, called Technocracy Incorporated. And flowed out of a just kind of a loose-knit group called Technocracy in general, that was based originally at Columbia University in New York City. And this historic movement, and when I say historic, I mean it actually existed. There was over 500,000 card-carrying members in this organization for some period of time during the 30s and early 1940s. And it was big in Canada, as well as the United States. It spread all across the provinces in Canada, and it was mostly centered in the West in the United States, but there was also quite a few people in the East and the Midwest, in the middle of our country as well. And this organization proposed to create a brand, to replace capitalism and propose a brand new economic system called technocracy. That's what it was. It was an economic system, not a political system. And they had to have political implications, but it was primarily designed to replace capitalism, which at the time in the 1930s appeared to many people to be dead because of the Great Depression. And so these scientists and engineers who believed that they and they alone could rescue the country created this alternative economic model called technocracy. It would be an energy-based system rather than a price-based supply and demand system. And it would encompass every possible conceivable corner of the economic system, the monetary system, the entire economic system. It was all pervasive. And so anyway, that's when I ran across historic technocracy, I began to see the names of Trilateral Commission members pop up in the current day as doing things that these people said to do back in the 1930s. All of a sudden, it just hit me like a ton of bricks, Sheila, that what the Trilateral Commission meant by new international economic order was not really, it wasn't capitalism. It wasn't capitalism warmed over. It was a brand new economic system. And it was exactly the same stuff that technocracy had proposed in the 1930s. That got my attention. That's why we're talking today. That's why I wrote my book. Right. This had to be said.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you mentioned the Trilateral Commission. And, I mean, obviously it was kind of David Rockefeller's baby along with Nazi power machine Brzezinski, hence the Trilateral when you talk about America's Europe and Asia. And you talked about back in the 30s, there was a huge move in the United States. And really what we were looking at here was these people, and some of them the same people, were really looking for a replacement economic system. And it's funny because David Rockefeller and Brzezinski both had said, and this is on record, that they were trying to design, if you will, or start a one-world economic system. Interesting.
Yes, and this is what they've done it with, is with technocracy. I would hasten to point out that there was no institutional money back in the 1930s for these people.
Right.
They did have a little bit of support at Columbia University, which is very closely allied with the Rockefeller crowd, but it only lasted for about a year before one of the co-founders was discovered to be a fraud, and Columbia subsequently booted the entire movement. I mean, they drop-kicked them. They punted them right out of the university. And they were very offended that they had been taken, if you will, by the charlatan. And so they went off and they started Technocracy Incorporated right after that in New York City. But there was no grants. The Mellons were not around. The Carnegies were not around. The Rockefellers were not around. And so it was just a membership organization, generally poor, the whole time. They were always struggling for money. And not until 1973, actually it was a couple years before that, do we see technocracy resurfacing with Zbigniew Brzezinski, who, by the way, was a professor at the time at Columbia University.
Well, that was Obama's professor.
Yes. So that's right. And so here he is at Columbia University. He writes a book called Between Two Ages.
Yeah.
We knew back in the 70s that was the book that endeared Rockefeller to Brzezinski. That's why they went to a Bilderberg meeting in 1972. Rockefeller took Brzezinski over there, and they plied the membership there with, hey, what do you think about starting something like this trilateral commission thing? They bounced the idea off the Bilderberg group, got tremendous encouragement to do it, and they came back and they started in 1973. That is the commission. What I didn't fully understand in the 70s about Brzezinski's book, and we talked about it a lot, but the subtitle of his book is the key here. The title is Between Two Ages. The subtitle is America's Role in the Technotronic Era. The word technotronic, as in my opinion, as has turned out now, I've gone back and reread his book with my knowledge of technocracy, he was actually describing a knockoff of the early technocracy from the 1930s. That's what he meant by technotronic. It was going to be the incursion of technology into society used to control that society, for instance, along the lines of, in the end, of a scientific dictatorship. But this is what Brzezinski wrote about in 1970. They started the Trilateral Commission in 1973, and then all of the things that they began to do from that day forward, Sheila, have brought us to the state where we are today, with Agenda 21 being pushed by the United Nations, sustainable development, climate change, everything, everywhere, green economy. We could go on down the line with supporting programs, Common Core, Smart Grid, public-private partnerships, the whole concept there, councils of governments, which are regional government organizations that have been oppressed on our country. And all of these things together are what these people call deep transformation. This is a buzzword, by the way. This is one of those coded words that they use at the UN. Deep transformation has to do with completely reforming, changing the fabric of the world, society and the world, the economic system and the political governance and so on. It's a big story on one hand, too big for some people. It's just too big. I can't believe anything that big has been right under our nose all this time. But listen, here's the evidence. Here's the evidence that my conclusion is right about technocracy. I don't say this. I have no ego in this. You got to understand this. As you know me better, this is not about me. This is about what's happening to our country and our world. Forget the book. The information in the book is what the key is here. But Christiana Figueres, the climate change czar at the United Nations.
I'm well familiar with Christine.
she's the big kahuna there. And literally, she's executive secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. She's the one that's going to be probably cozying up to the Pope this fall at the huge meeting that they're going to have at the UN on climate change that the Pope wrote his recent encyclical for. But here's what Figueres let slip in early February of 2015. This is a direct quote from a press conference she had in Europe. She said, quote, "This is the first time in the history of mankind that we are setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution." You heard this.
I actually wrote an article on this because this is a stunning confession, Patrick.
Well, what she's confessing to is not just they're going to replace capitalism, but it's what she doesn't say in here, what are they going to replace it with?
Well,
that's
a greater question, and that is a perfect segue to what they are going to replace it with. So where I want to start here, take us backwards. Now, let's start off with how this sort of emerged. Now, you have a whole bunch of things happening, not just in the 1700s, 1800s, but let's go to about the 1920s and 30s. Let's talk about a few of these characters that really were starting to bring this nexus or fusion, if you like, of science and sociology, which is a very frightening thought. But let's walk people to how this sort of took off.
Well, the father of technocracy today has been widely hailed as being a French philosopher by the name of Henri de Saint-Simon. And he lived between 1860 and 1825. But he's generally credited as being the, kind of like the founding fathers of America. He is kind of the founding father of technocracy. And he wrote about scientism and science and scientists and so on. And here's the attitude that Saint Simon started out with. This is one of his papers. He said, "A scientist, my dear friends, is a man who foresees. It is because science provides the means to predict that it is useful, and scientists are superior to all other men." Close quote. Now, this is a dangerous attitude for a number of reasons. It sets scientism up as a religion, not just merely a scientific proposition. Because he says here that a scientist is a man who foresees, like he has a crystal ball, in the sense that, the same sense that religion sees the future. At least that's what they all say they do. And secondly, that scientists are like a priesthood, superior to all other men.
Yeah.
And so, this is a bad place to start. But Saint Simon was a very religious man. And he really did believe that there needed to be a priesthood of scientists and engineers that would administrate all affairs of society to society, especially all of the economic issues and stuff that society has. And so everything from that time forward with Auguste Comte all the way through to the early the Darwin days, all the way into the early 1900s, you had this philosophy that was kind of spinning the whole metaphysical concept of achieving the Holy Grail and eternal life and stuff like that, mixing with actual technology that was being developed during those days. And kind of a curious blend showed up in the early 1900s where people were thinking all of a sudden, gee, technology has invaded society in such a way that it's changing the very fabric of society. And therefore, the traditional tools that we've had to run society are no longer adequate. So some scientists and engineers rose to that occasion thinking, wow, I really am better than everybody else. I should stand up and take my place as a high priest of science and administer science to society for its own good because it doesn't know what it's doing anyway. And this is kind of the attitude that started this whole thing out.
Wow.
It's incredible. And I want to say, I do not bash scientists and engineers. I know many people who are in various professions who are wonderful people. Their heads are screwed on right. They're just real people. They don't view themselves as being better than all other men. And they're not trying to force some religious proposition down everybody's throat, like Al Gore is, for instance, when he says, if you don't believe climate change like me, you're a denier and you deserve to be punished.
Yeah, punished. They'd like to see us all jailed. Well, consider what Al Gore's pal Naomi Oreskes, the affiliate professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University, she likes the idea of having climate deniers prosecuted under the RICO Act, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act. And it's not just that. There's other senators now jumping on board for having climate criminals like myself prosecuted at the highest level. And you would think it'd be a fusion of Marxism that's interwoven in this very clever agenda. But the dark horse of the New World Order is not communism, socialism, or fascism. It is technocracy. And the interesting thing is, when you look around the 1920s, in many ways, National Socialism is very much intertwined with technocracy, isn't it?
Well, in many ways, it is. And just removing the concept of National Socialism just for a minute, I'll back up and say that in the 1930s, as soon as Technocracy Inc. got started here in America, a parallel organization showed up in Germany. It was called Technocracy over there as well, in German, of course. They didn't use the English word technocracy. They used the German word technocracy. They started a newspaper, a magazine in Germany. It was quite popular, just like it was here. It was very popular. It was one of those radical ideas that people, especially engineers, really grabbed a hold of. And so they had a lot of adherence in Germany, and there was no, as far as we can tell, there's no organizational connection between the two groups here and in Germany. However, the people in Germany, the technocrats in Germany, merely translated the articles in the from the American magazine, and they just merely reprinted most of them in the German magazine, right? So the Technocracy magazine in both countries had basically the same articles. That shows an obvious intellectual tie-in. The technocrat organization ran afoul of Hitler because he viewed it as a competitive system. He didn't allow any of that kind of stuff. So he banned the technocracy movement per se, just as an organization. But he loved science, and he did not ban the technocrats that made up that organization. And what we found in looking back in history is that the early technocrats in the German system that were providing the technology for Germany to do what it did during World War II, those technocrats were communicating with each other across the columns of power that Hitler had set up to, for his conquering engine. And Hitler was very paranoid. He set up all these different columns of power, if you will. He never allowed them to talk to each other, to coordinate stuff, because he didn't want them ganging up on him. So he didn't allow inter-column communications in many cases. But we found out later that the technocrats were continuously kibitzing with each other back and forth, all during World War II, to coordinate technology and to cooperate with technology across those, these different centers of power. IBM was right there, by the way, with them during those days to supply the computing capabilities. Yes. With their early tabulators and so on to do statistical analysis and scheduling trains to go to Auschwitz and stuff like that. It was a very dark, dark time for everybody. But these technocrats lived all the way through the German experience. At the end of World War II, when all of the politicians were carted off to Nuremberg, all of the technocrats from Germany were brought back into the United States under a top secret program called Operation Paperclip, which has now been declassified, by the way. There's a couple of books been written on it. It's very amazing stuff.
Yes.
These technocrats were reunited. Now, you can just picture this. They were reunited with their American buddies after 15 years of war and horrible things happening, which these people were instrumental in doing. These technocrats came back to America under secret government contracts placed into places like NASA and, top military establishment, the early forerunners of DARPA and stuff like that. These people came back into our government, were scrubbed of all their deeds, given new identities in some cases completely. Most of them ended up retiring with Social Security and retirement funds and stuff, and most, I think, all but maybe one or two now are dead. But this was an incredible stage of history where the technocrats merely submerged their technocrat vehicle, if you will, and just continued underwater until the end of World War II. And then they all just kind of came over to America and got together with their buddies again. And this whole technocratic influence is still at the core of America's governmental operation, the stuff that's killing us. They're still there. These people were nefarious back then, and they're still nefarious today. This is one of the great dangers that you see when you begin to understand technocracy and what it is historically. You conclude at the end of it, oh my gosh, we thought we got rid of Hitler, but we never got rid of these people.
Well,
they,
you mentioned Hitler, of course, but I mean, I was thinking, right on the heels of the Bolshevik Revolution and the socialist movement in Europe, and you've got this rise of the Nazi Germany. So you got a picture of what was going on concurrent to all this. I mean, there was a lot of philosophical movements in America. And think about the U.S. I mean, they were really active. You have the progressive movement coming up strong and fast. You had the radical new societal ideas, got the philosophical principles of positivism really being interwoven into all this, don't you?
Well, you do, and it was a cauldron back in those days. I can appreciate that. Our day today is not quite like this, I don't think, but back in those days, there were so many radical movements floating around. You had all of the concept of Darwinism being, you know, put out to the public at that point. Yes. That excited people. The whole progressive movement had a number of different schisms to it, different things that they were thinking about. You had communism. You had the Bolshevik Revolution that just happened. You had the early days of fascism was rising up in Europe especially. There was some call for that even in America. But all of these philosophical movements were colliding head on with each other, and there was almost a competition. I view it as a competition where people who would sit around in the coffee shops of those days, if you will, and argue over political philosophy, there was always a competition to come up with the next latest and greatest thing. You know, well, I can outdo that. What? You're a communist? Oh, shoot, that's nothing. You know, let me tell you what I got. And then they would trot out some other crazy idea. Right. And there was a lot of this kind of discussion going on back then, a lot of interaction between, for instance, the Marxist and the communist. And, the Bolshevik communists went radical. The American communists said, no, we're going to go peaceful. And so there was a lot of discussion about that. And, you know, I don't think that any one of these different trains of thought ended up in its purest form in the end. They were all kind of influenced by each other as they argued and talked about, talked through current events and the implications and the theories and so on, the outcomes. They probably all got influenced by each other to some extent. But you still, in the world, over the last 100 years, you still see a very clear track on communism, a very clear track on fascism. And today, many people look at the world and say, "Oh, it's going to a fascist state where the corporations are bonded with the governments." And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence to that, just looking at it. But when you understand technocracy and what it's all about, you realize, no, that's, it looks like fascism. Sometimes it looks like communism, but it's neither. And back in the 30s, if you wanted to start a fist fight, go find a technocrat and call him a communist. Oh, they got upset. Really just livid. Oh, how dare you? We're not communists. We have nothing to do with communists. That's kind of shocking. And I still think they feel the same way today. Brzezinski was not a communist. He was not a Marxist. He said in his book himself, from his own words, he says, Marxism is necessary. It's a necessary stepping stone. But the only reason it's a stepping stone is because it's headed right for the technotronic era. We need Marxism as a pass-through to get to the technotronic era. And so he never really claimed to be a Marxist. He claimed to be a technotronic guy, right? A technocrat.
Well, even Karl Marx, though, was very, very enamored with this technocracy. I mean, these guys back in Karl Marx's day were sort of on the train of thought of proposing this kind of society where science would merge with the society, sort of this scientism to a whole new, well, really taking positivism to a whole new level. It's like positivism on steroids. It was almost like they wanted to reject all other forms of truth except that which could be discovered really through science.
Well, they stated that pointedly. That was the whole point of scientism, as it kind of emerged out of the positivism philosophy. Scientism was more radical than just positivism, in that it's very clearly stated the only way to discover truth about the universe and the nature of man was through the scientific method. That's what they said. And they rejected any type of truth that would come out of the Bible, for instance, biblical truth. They completely rejected that. They weren't atheists. They weren't militant atheists per se, but they rejected any truth that had any other source. And if it couldn't be demonstrated by the scientific method, they said it was just not true. There was just no way to even deal with it. And that's pretty shallow in a number of ways. I mean, you know, people can, you know, go try that out on your spouse, you know, and say, well, you know, science says that there is no such thing as love, really. It's just our illusion. And there really is no reason for people to be married in a monogamous relationship. So you know. I mean, just try that line of thinking out on your spouse and see how far you get before they kill you. But, you know, there's lots of truth outside of the scientific method. All of the human emotions are obviously not quantifiable by the scientific method, whether it be love or passion or you know, jealousy, envy, you know, so on, commitment. And, you know, these people are just off base. But today, we see the same philosophy exerted today, for instance, at the United Nations when they talk about climate change, when they talk about sustainable development. Because if you don't believe what they're convinced is right through their pseudoscience and, you know, pseudoscientific studies, you are the denier, you are the heretic.
Well, yeah, and this phony junk pseudoscience, you know, as we talked about these climate criminals like me, I mean, don't they know the science is settled, Patrick? Despite the fact that 100,000 climate scientists like my good friend Dr. Timothy Ball has said, you know, but yet the UN and Al Gore and other hucksters have always said the science is settled. Not only is the science not settled, Patrick, but the science is unsettling. And ClimateGate's leaked emails from the East, you know, University of East Anglia shows that they were trying to get rid of not only the medieval warm period, but they actually doctored a lot of climatological information. They knew the stick was manufactured. The good old famous mother of all subterfuge, Michael Mann's climatological bogus hockey stick there. So that whole combination just goes to prove, you know, we're dealing with a lot of liars and unscrupulous charlatans. But the point is, you always have this undertone of, and here's the word, and it's right in your book, and it's global transformation, because the world needs to be in balance of nature. And as Al Gore says in his book, Earth in the Balance, this earth is a sentient being that we need to be bowing down to Gaia. And so hence you have Agenda 21, Sheila's favorite topic, smart grid, smart meters, smart appliances. They're switching out everything we have. We're being hacked, tracked, and attacked while these guys spy, lie, and pry. I mean, it's absolutely the data mining. That is what is stunning right now. I mean, this is really the what these guys you talk about in the 1920s envisioned with the kind of technology we have today.
I'll tell you, they did. Let me read you the first five requirements of technocracy written in 1934 by M. King Hubbard, who was a co-founder of Technocracy Incorporated. He was not the charlatan, by the way. He was
a
genuine.
Is he related to Ron Hubbard?
No, he's not. Not at all. But M. King Hubbard was the guy who invented or proposed the peak oil theory in 1954. That was 20 years later. Same guy. He was the founder of Technocracy. They were very careful to write down requirements on what it would take to make technocracy happen as an economic system. And you have to hand it to science and engineers in their ability to document things. They do very good at that.
And now they're saying, they're using the word peak water. You'll love that, Patrick.
Oh, I know. This is ridiculous. Don't get me started on that. That's a whole other thing.
That's another show. But,
oh, it really is. That's a sidetrack right now. But let me read you the first five requirements of technocracy. Number one, this is pop your eyeballs out. Number one, quote, register on a continuous 24-hour-per-day basis the total net conversion of energy. Number two, quote, by means of the registration of energy converted and consumed, make possible a balanced load. Number three, quote, provide a continuous inventory of all production and consumption. Number four, quote, provide a specific registration of the type, kind, etc. of all goods and services where produced and where used. Number five, quote, provide specific registration of the consumption of each individual plus a record and description of the individual, close quote.
Wow.
Those were the first five things that they didn't have the technology to actually do in those days. But that, you see, we just knocked off, in those first five requirements, we just knocked off smart grid and smart meters, number one. Because doesn't a utility just talk about balanced load? That's all they talk about. Balancing the load on your back, of course, not theirs. But then we also just dealt with the total awareness society concept where information is being vacuumed up at breakneck speed everywhere in the world, not just in America, but in Canada as well, in Europe, all over the world, same thing is happening. We have in our country Obamacare, which is not about your health for sure. It's about the data that they're collecting. It's all going into that national database. Common Core is not about education. It is about conditioning, but it's not about education. It's about the 400 data points that they're collecting on every student that goes through our school system. That's going into the master database. And then you have all the phone calls you have that are being transcribed. You have all the emails that are being sent back and forth. Every financial record, every time you click a purchase or something, all of that financial information is being sucked up, vacuumed up by this seemingly endless database in the sky. And you say, why are they doing this? Well, you see, they knew back then that if you can't, you cannot manage a society unless you have the ability to monitor that society. You have to have monitoring, and monitoring means data. That's that simple.
This is a total net conversion of production, consumption of goods and services of each individual. This is a sci-fi measuring and monitoring program. And it's, you know, this is really data mining on nitrous oxide here. And think about, Patrick, all these smart saver cards.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't even use them anymore because it's just one big, gigantic data mining tool. But think about this, folks. All your communications are being tracked and hacked, your buying patterns, your, as Patrick said, your phone conversations, your medical records, your bank accounts. I mean, this is just Big Brother. You know, it's monitoring behavior and patterns. Is a person a minion, or do they speak out? Are they a rebel rouser like that Patrick Wood and Sheila Zelinsky? I mean, it's really Gestapo level surveillance. I mean, you look at the NSA, you look at the Edward Snowden revelations. I mean, we are just really cannon fodder to these people, aren't we?
That's true. And I have to say, Hitler would have killed for this technology. He really, if Hitler had had the level of technology he had today, we'd all be wearing jackboots.
I think that Hitler would absolutely salivate at the idea of some of these transhuman, you know, the nanotech, the biotech, what they have today is quite frightening. But what's also very frightening, and this is where I want to get into this, is that the churches now, you'll remember a few years ago, good old Bill Hybel, Mr. Emergent Church there, and you've got Rick Chrislam, Warren, Mr. Purpose Driven Life. Now, these guys, Rick Warren is a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. You've got Peter Drucker, and this is really quite stunning. Get into that.
Well, the transformation of the evangelical church has just been that dramatic. Back in the 80s, Peter Drucker, a secular management consultant who was an evangelist for the philosophy of communitarianism, teamed up with a Christian businessman by the name of Bob Drucker. Drucker had a lot of money Buford had a lot of money, and Drucker had a lot of ideas, and Drucker wanted to influence the church because he believed that society sat on a three-legged stool. It had the economic component, the political component, but it needed a social component in order to work. So he decided he's going to take after the church, and he got together with Buford, and they together started working with Buford's organization called Leadership Network to train pastors on how to build megachurches. And as it turns out, there were several young pastors at that time. The first early disciples who went through their program were people like Rick Warren. And so Rick Warren, his first influence, major influence in life, was from Peter Drucker. And Drucker basically, with his philosophy of communitarianism, he trained community organizers is what he did. Because he felt that communities would only stick together if there was a religious component making them stick together. So this whole philosophy has gone out to the mega churches around the country. It's been very popular, especially with the emerging church movement. But it's all over the nation today. And, well, actually all over the world, not just our country, but it's everywhere now. But what's happened is pastors have been converted from being shepherds, which is the biblical role of a pastor, to be a shepherd of the people, to being community organizers. you see. It's like, this is pretty stunning, but if you kind of look around at some of the pastors and what they're doing in their communities, you know, to get everybody together and sing Kumbaya and, you know, have all these social things going on to save their city and to save their, you know, heal their land, all this kind of stuff, you realize that these people are just sophisticated community organizers. And probably the lowball shot at this is, gee, I know another community organizer who happens to be the president of the United States. Yeah,
wasn't that his only claim to fame, good old Bathhouse Barry?
I know. So, you know, there's a lot of pastors that are running, there are a lot of community organizers running around masquerading as pastors in the evangelical church today. And they're not doing any good for the kingdom, for sure. But they are following Drucker's original, you know, goals to kind of bring society into all this thing. And so, you know, we see, yeah, it's no surprise that Drucker goes and joins the Council on Foreign Relations. You know, that makes perfect sense. So the evangelical movement has been co-opted, but so has the mainline denominational movement been co-opted as well. And even just last year, there was a big conference called the Interfaith Summit on Climate Change. All of the churches of the world came, not just churches, but other religious groups as well. The World Council of Churches stated about that meeting, they had a press release right after the thing was over. They said, and this is a direct quote, "There has never been such a large amount of religious environmental activity in one location in the history of the world. This week will mark a watershed in the history of religion. It will be the time that people remember as the time when the world's faiths declared themselves irrevocably as green faiths."
Whoa. These guys proposed the megachurch really to shore up the last leg and tilt it towards really a globalist technocracy system. You talked about that three-legged stool. The religion, economics, and government is really interwoven there. And yes, it's not surprising that Rick Warren has been very instrumental in throwing those terms around. So you've got these guys really synchronizing the church with global principles, really. So you've got these community organizers. The community church has now become a building block for technocracy. That's a frightening thought.
Well, it is. And I want to point out from Revelation 17, that I'm not going to develop this concept right now, but there is a very strange image of a woman. She's called a whore, actually, but there's a woman dressed in scarlet riding a beast, who is usually identified as the Antichrist. I would support that. And the woman generally is identified as a religious system. She's riding the beast and being supported, if you will, by the beast, but it's also indicated in that chapter that this religious system was responsible for bringing the Antichrist to power in the first place. There was a merging, if you will, of religion and state. And what's interesting to me is we look at this, what's going on today. This is a clue. This is just a clue. I don't want to be dogmatic about it. But there's a clue here that it's not going to be economic fascism in the end that converts or subverts the whole world. But there's going to be increasingly so as we move forward, there's going to be a religious bonding with the state to create this one world system that will behave like a scientific dictatorship. And we actually see this bonding of religion taking place by such stuff we're talking about right now. The green faith. So all the denominations of the world are chasing after this religious proposition of earth worship, which was never in the church before, but it is now. These religious precepts from scientism are dominating and taking over the church all throughout the world. And the church is like absorbing this, putting it back down to the people and says, you people down here, get in line with this because this is the way it's going to be. So the Pope is going to beat this to death, saying we need global governance. We need it now.
Well, actually, not only is he, actually the Italian document says they want a world global court, a global dictatorship that is like an environmental world court.
Yes. That's exactly right. So we see this bonding of religion with government. This is very dangerous. Historically, it's been dangerous, and it's dangerous today as well. And it's also just kind of interesting that we, you know, when we think back, that the only religion that is not permitted in the a seat at the table is Christianity. Nothing to do with the Bible, nothing to do with Israel, nothing to do with the evangelical church, the Bible in particular. all of those sorts of things are not allowed. But we've driven prayer out of school. We've driven, you know, Christianity out of the public domain in America, even though we were founded on biblical principles. But every other cockeyed thing can come in and take its place. It's just, no. Can't have, if it's the Bible, you cannot use that book anywhere here. But in the meantime, the entire religious movement throughout the world is drinking from this cup of environmentalism. They're drinking it with abandon. You know, they can't get enough.
So in other words, let's forget about heavenly things and let's focus on runaway global warming.
Oh, that's right.
So, I mean, we can see that, though, Patrick, this seeker-friendly, more relevant, let's get with the times, more tolerant, more politically correct. Actually, this is really humanism we're talking about.
It is humanism, for sure, because humanism always stated that man is the end of all things. This is a little bit different, for instance, when you express it in terms of transhumanism, which postulates that technology is going to change the fabric of man so that he can escape the laws of sin and death altogether and become immortal, become omniscient, become all-powerful, etc. This is a false premise in my very strong opinion. But this is what we see today. So, yes, humanism was at its base. But now it's matured. Evolution was at its base. But now transhumanists, for instance, say that we will control the evolutionary process from here on. So what's interesting is they reject intelligent design, but then they turn around now and say, well, no, we now embrace intelligent design because we are the designers. It's crazy.
Well, but when you think about, you've talked about this in your book, Transhumanism, and when you think about the nanotech, the biotech, when you think about post-man, which is a stunning term, post-man, machine, post-human, cyborg, synthetic biology, transhumanist, because when you think about technology, it's really advancing exponentially. You've got synthetic DNA. They've apparently created synthetic blood. We can create an individual in a lab now. China created the first genetically engineered embryo. You know, you're modifying the genes of a cell and the genome. You're manufacturing humans, really, essentially. The re-brain engineering, you look at DARPA cortical modems, neurostimulation. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there. There's augmented cognition projects brought to you by our good old friends at DARPA. I mean, this is quite stunning what's going on.
It is. And we need to be careful, however, not to be deceived in the same way by the advances in technology that may or may not lead to, this post-human state. The post-human movement before technology came in was strictly a metaphysical proposition. And there were lots of people that were adherents to that without technology. But now that the metaphysical movement has merged with technology, they're basically saying, okay, here's the proof that what we said originally was right. You know, here's the proof, the anecdotal evidence that we're headed in the right direction, that we're going to achieve immortality, for instance. But will they actually achieve immortality? Will they be able to live forever? Will they be able to download their brains, as Ray Kurzweil says, into a computer and capture the soul of a person in computer silicon? You know, they think, yes, we're going to do this. We know we're going to do this because X, Y, and Z are happening today. We extrapolate the trends. You know, the computers are going to get bigger and better. And we know that we're going to do this in the future. I would be very careful, however, personally, to not fall into the trap of believing that this is a fait accompli, because I don't think it is at all. And one of the reasons I say that is, at least as having a biblical worldview, the Bible is very clear. It states that it's appointed for man once to die, and then comes judgment. Now, if they achieve immortality, they're going to completely invalidate the Bible. You can take that for what it's worth. Will they invalidate the Bible? Will in fact, that's one of the most important premises in the Bible, because death entered into the world, according to the Bible, through Adam, who sinned. And, it wasn't God just having fun, saying, I'm going to punish this little rascal. But, you know, because he sinned, death entered the world. That's what the Bible says at the very beginning. And at the very end of it, it says, yes, God is going to judge the world and all the things in it because of, you know, its rebellion against him. And so if man is really going to, escape death altogether, then we can just rip the Bible up, throw it out the door. There is no God, and God is just not, never was there in the first place. I'm not ready to make that proposition at all, personally.
Well, I guess because if you can create a person in a lab, what would the implication for belief in God be? People wouldn't need God if you're just going to create people in labs.
Well, no, you wouldn't. And, you know, this is not only just in that, but, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, other forms of life, about chimeras, for instance, where you're, you may have half human and half something else. Here's the problem with this. I just look back at the Bible at this to kind of argue this point. The Bible says that Jesus came to die for Adam's race. He died for Adam. He was a second Adam. He died for Adam. And he becomes the propitiation, if you will, to make a way for man to get back in relationship with God again. That was the whole proposition of the Bible from beginning to end. And so if all of a sudden some half-breed race is introduced that's not really human and it's not really something else, did Jesus not die for those people? Well, see, this is the problem because, you know, John 1 says, God so loved the world, or 3:16 rather, God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that any who come may, you know, will not perish, but be able to receive eternal life. So it's not really a biblical concept. It might be extra biblical, but it's not a biblical concept that there will ever be more races than the race of Adam on planet Earth. That's kind of a presupposition in the Bible. There's only one race of people, and it's from the race of Adam. And so these people promise that they're going to create another race. I'm not so sure that that's just part of the big deception, that they think they are in rebelling against God, because they're certainly not including God in the proposition. The whole ball of wax with sustainable development, Agenda 21, has been pressed down to every local community in the world today. It's in my town here in Phoenix and all the surrounding area in the counties, Maricopa County down here, and as far as I know, across the country, our country, it's everywhere. And I know it's that way in Canada as well. And if there's going to be any resistance against this movement today, it's going to be on a local basis, not a national basis. That's just my opinion. There's nothing we can do on a national basis at this point in our country to turn the tide of technocracy back. But we can talk to our local officials and challenge them, and the ones that refuse to listen, to abandon this stuff, run them out of office at least. If we do nothing, we're assured of the outcome. And I don't like that. I don't like the outcome where it's going. I would rather die fighting it, I guess, than I would just, you know, die rolling, having it roll over me like a steamroller and flatten me. But it is everywhere, and if people don't stand up in their own communities and challenge these ideas, they'll never be challenged. They're going to be taken as fact, and people will just continue to teach them in schools, and our children, our students are just going to be sucking this up, lapping it up like there's no tomorrow. And, you know, those of us who are seeing this more correctly will just die as fossils and dinosaurs and be forgotten by history. I'm not to that place right now, but I think people need to take a stand locally and do something about this. Secondly, they're from a concept of Christianity. Those people who would hold to a biblical worldview need to understand two things here. One, yes, you need to understand the Bible. Read the Bible. Read it for yourself. Find out what's in there. And if you believe it, then you need to apply it to your world so that you can properly see what's going on in the world. That's what a biblical worldview means. And theoretically, if you think about it, you cannot have a proper biblical worldview. You may know the Bible backwards and forwards. Maybe you've read it 50 times and you really know it. You've memorized whole passages. You really understand it. But if your view of the world is based on a fantasy, what does that say about your biblical worldview? Will it be of any good to you or any use to you? I don't think so. It's important for Christians to see the world as it really is. and to understand the forces that are going on in the world so that they can apply what they know from the Bible to that worldview, to that actually what's going on in the world. So I think a technocracy really brings something to the table on that. It just it squares up a lot of stuff that was never really been clearly understood before. And it just kind of tears the veil away from what's going on. Technocracy has been with us for a very long time. It's not new. It's historically validated and documented. It really helps people see a lot of things about what's going on and also explains a lot of things that relate to Bible prophecy as well. And that's another exciting topic, I think, that that people should revitalize today, is getting more interested and more excited about Bible prophecy, not believing people like Rick Warren, who says studying Bible prophecy is a waste of time. I don't believe that at all. But most of the modern day teachers saying, no, you can forget Bible prophecy. We don't need that. We just need to roll up our sleeves and, you know, heal our land, get everything straightened up, whatever. Well, yes, I agree that Christians should be active in their world for the people that God has put in their life. I think they should be. But on the other hand, you know, our purpose is a little bit greater than that. As we interact with the King, if you will, we know the kingdom is coming someday when the King returns. In the meantime, we're still down here, doing our best to make an impact, to bring the gospel to as many people as we can, for sure, and also to help those that have already accepted the gospel to understand what the heck is going on.
Well, and I think the good news is America's rejected technocracy back in the 30s. They can do it again. But really, as you say, only if technocracy is seen for what it is. And I think that it's very important. I mean, Jesus said in the word, occupy until I come. He didn't, you know, say sit around, sing kumbaya while Rome burns around us either. He didn't say go ye therefore into all the world and fight runaway global warming. People really have to talk to their church congregants, their pastors, and really it's incumbent upon us to talk to people about the truth.
Yes, it really is. We need to have more public debate, public discussion about these ideas to bring the light of day. And Al Gore would say out of hand that you deniers have no place at the table whatsoever. I say, Al Gore, I will take a place at the table because I'm a member of society, period. And you can't tell me that I don't have a place at the table. We will discuss these things. I'm sorry. We're going to discuss them. You may not like them, but we're going to discuss them.
Well, it hasn't been warming in 17 years, and the only hot air I see is Al Gore, and I say to him, cool it, Al Gore.
you weren't around in the 1970s when global cooling was a big thing. But we were all going to die. They said, you need to buy fur coats because we're all going to die. The ice age is coming upon us. We're all going to die.
Yeah. It's just, oh, how the paradigm has shifted. Now we've got, you know, polar bears disappearing and sea levels rising. And, you know, it's amazing. Al Gore buys a deluxe $14 million oceanfront property on the ocean, but sea levels will rise. Patrick, it was such a pleasure to have you on. Give out your website for the folks and how they can get a copy of this amazing book, Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation.
Certainly. My book website is just technocracyrising.com. That's easy to find. The book's available there from me. I'll send out a signed copy. But it's also available on Amazon.com, and there's a Kindle version on Amazon. If you like to have an e-reader type of a book, I like the real book myself, but different strokes for different folks. So they can get it any number of places. They can go and request it at the bookstore. And if you have a library, if you can't afford it, go to the library and ask them to get a book from their distributor so you can borrow it from the library. I'd love to see my book in libraries across the country and even across Canada as well.
Well, I certainly would too. And again, folks, I really highly encourage you to get it. Patrick, thank you so much for coming on. I hope you do come back and see us soon.
My pleasure. Love to help out anytime.
Thanks, Patrick. Folks, that was Patrick Wood, author of Technocracy Rising, and his website is technocracyrising.com. It is also bookmarked there today on the bio at weekendvigilante.com. And remember that Listen Live Weekdays button on my website, the black and pink button with the microphone, says Join Live Chat. It'll automatically take you to the chat. So please do sign up for that. And you can join us daily in the chat forum. Folks, we have an amazing show tomorrow. We have Chuck Baldwin in the first half, and then Tim Baldwin, his son, in the second half. It is going to be a fantastic show. And just a reminder that next week, my Green Gospel book will be available for pre-order mid-next week. Again, I'm very excited to get this book, Green Gospel, The New World Religion. It really has become a new religion. Environmentalism has indeed become a new religion. Folks, thank you so much for tuning into the broadcast tonight. And just a reminder, please do support the ministry. We're now into July, and I'm asking, please help me cover my airtime costs so that I can stay on the air. I appreciate that. Good night, and God bless.